Welcome to the ANews podcast. This is episode 89 for November 9th, 2018. This podcast covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversations from the previous week on anarchistnews.org. It's designed to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Give us feedback and constructive criticism at our email address, podcast@anarchistnews.org. Editorial. No one wants to see their parents dancing. I think I've talked before about a friend who argues for sin, because without sin, he says, there can be no real transgression. I would say I get excited about something different but related. What is most exciting to me is the space between clear and defined poles. Obviously, even that way of talking about it is overly dualistic, but you know what I mean. Gloria Anzaldúa talks about borderlands, so I guess I mean that. When I was, very briefly, helping to book shows, what I wanted to do was put hip-hop bands with punk bands, both because I thought the conversations would be more interesting and because I wanted to mix shit up. I guess my point is that those are the same. Mixing shit up makes for more interesting conversations, gets people out of ruts, makes people look at things differently, reminds us of our potential and the potential of others. Potential in a good way. I'm thinking about this because this is yet another week of strangers being scared off by what seems to be the reputation of one of my projects. Hard to know what exactly is going on because honest communication isn't really happening. I could go into more detail, but today I'm pondering the phenomenon of being in the middle of conflict a lot and what it means to continue to try to communicate from the inside of this storm. And it brings me back to how mixing things up works over time. Because I guess what I'm thinking about now is that there's a window during which one gets to organize events where other people or other scenes are the defined territory. If I had continued to book shows that mixed different communities and or genres, then my shows would have eventually become a territory that had its own boundaries. And that's what has happened to me and what I've done to myself. My project and I have become one of the poles that other people get to move around. I guess this is what success looks like, if success means lasting, maintaining, a sustained presence. Another way to talk about it is that people will build walls around anything that is stable. Kind of attenuated parent issues. It's the rare person who likes it when stable things also shimmy and shake. But I'm from California. Feels like home to me. If you need that something, but don't know what it is, shake, shake, shake it up and make it live. You've got to twist your body, twirl it all around, make it pop and sizzle. Now squish it on the ground. If you need that something, but don't know what it is, shake, shake, shake. What's new this week? Lessons regarding warfare on confronting J20 repression from It's Going Down. By this time, some of you have probably figured out that I strongly support personal reflections on common anarchist experiences like prison, snitches, groups falling apart, relationships exploding, etc., so that we can all learn from each other. This article is that, about J20, from someone who was a defendant, and here talks about what worked and didn't work for them regarding jail solidarity, etc. Some good anarchist checkboxes were marked, at least for me, and I think this is well worth reading for folks doing actions or defending those who do actions, or both. That's all of us, right? Quote, if I tried to point out the anarchic desert, I was told multiple times by co-defendants and supporters that my method of organizing was too, quote, informal, unquote. That having people pursue their own projects and attempt to coordinate efforts themselves lacked structure, or more accurately, discipline, and that people would be best served by the formality of the spokes call and its working groups. In truth, I find the question of formal versus informal as pointless as the one between violent versus nonviolent. What matters isn't the degree of formality used to plan or coordinations. What matters is whether there is something to coordinate. What matters is whether people are doing something that matters to them. Often, I found this discourse to be a way of covering up the clear dynamic at hand, a lack of initiatives and projects coming from ourselves as defendants, while also trying to recapture people within the larger body politic of the spokes calls, the collective, unquote.
Russia, free the network prisoners. From the Russian Reader, I guess? This is a first-person account by someone who has been following and writing about this repression since it started. It gives updates about some of the prisoners, one of whom is in particularly bad shape health-wise, and a list of things that we can do to show actual solidarity. Quote, Victor says he was really glad to go to Penza and hang out with all the other prisoners in the network case, although he did not enjoy the trip itself. The Penza remand prison was at such pains to show that none of the suspects in the network case were being tortured anymore that every evening all 10 suspects were inspected. They were forced to strip and undergo a full lookover, after which they were told to sign their names in a notebook. Victor got tired of signing his name, so he took to drawing smileys, but no one followed his lead. Unquote. Keeping a sense of humor, priceless.
anarchist zines and pamphlets published in October from Sprout Distro. The Ones Who Walk Away, two short stories by Le Guin, insurrectionary publication Dark Knights, number 47, Rebellion and Possibility, Voices in the Anti-ICE Struggle, Volume 2, The Secret World of Duvbo, Rupture, Autumn 2018, a European DIY zine, To Change Everything, the effort by Crime Think to update Fighting for Our Lives, and Step into the Unknown, a punk political personal zine that is a blast from the 90s.
A Call for Solidarity, the Libertarian Cultural Center of Almada. From Autonomies, CCL, the Centro de Cultura Libertario of Casilhas Almada, is asking for money. Quote, the Centro de Cultura Libertaria, an anarchist association with 44 years of activity in Casilhas Almada, Portugal, is again threatened. The continued pressure of the real estate business, the change in the rental law, and the gentrification that forces the departure of residents from the central spaces of cities, the destruction of nonprofit spaces, or the closure of neighborhood stores now also touches the CCL, unquote. There's a 5-minute video to go with the crowdfunding campaign, and that goes into a bit more detail about CCL's history.
Paul Average's An American Anarchist, The Life of Voltairine de Cleyre, from the San Diego Free Press by Mel Freilicher. The San Diego Free Press aims to be, quote, progressive and grassroots, or at least to bring that perspective. The opening sentence of this review just sounds like one more mainstream rag, describing the workers at AK Press as, quote, a self-professed group of anarchists, unquote. The review is of AK's reprint of Average's book on de Cleyre, but it's not in fact a review at all, merely a restatement of some of the facts of her life. It doesn't compare this book to any of the others about her, and there are a few, or to other anarchist biographies. It brings nothing to the table. So if you want a thumbnail sketch of de Cleyre's life and have forgotten the way to Wikipedia, there's this.
A list of new anarchist zines published by Warzone Distro. This is multiple months worth, so headlines only listed here. 1. Mapping the Fire, International Words of Solidarity with the Conspiracy of Cells of Fire. 2. Beyond the, quote, movement, unquote, anarchy. 3. Queers Gone Wild, an excerpt from Baden, number 1. 4. War Against the Information Age, a Future of Mass Social Control. 5. Smashing the Petri Dish. Abbreviated Inquiry into Abandoning the Concept of Culture. 6. Scandalous Thoughts. 7. A Few Notes on Civil Anarchism. 8. Questions the Authority of Psychiatry. 9. In Praise of Chaos. 10. I Am Also a Nihilist. 11. Fragment. Violence. 12. Drawing First Blood. 13. Decomposing the Masses Toward Armed Individuality. 14. Vegan Means Attack. Fomenting a Wildfire Against Speciesism and Moral Anthropocentrism. 15. Veganism from a Nihilist and Anti-Civ Perspective. And 16. Weaponizing Sobriety. Feral Anarchy Against Intoxication Culture.
Santiago, Chile. Anarchist Kevin Garrido murdered in prison. From Act for Freedom Now, which has since removed this story. This is the clear winner of the most controversial story of the week, partly because any whiff of ITS maintains the capacity to set things aflame. Also, Garrido's identity as an anarchist is in doubt, and assumptions about prison life internationally and assumptions about people who comment on A-News apparently all equals a small bonfire. The picture is apparently of Garrido spitting on a cop while being arrested. Good for him.
Of Movements and Midterms, Which Way to Actual Power? From It's Going Down by Salvo Papere. A pro-democracy, but you know, the people's democracy, pro-mass movement, pro-union and civil rights, piece by someone who wants to, quote, dramatically alter the political, economic, and social landscape we find ourselves in, unquote. A piece that is clearly designed for those who are new to anarchy or maybe even just new to politics. Quote, this is why we contend that beyond just winning concessions from power, our movements can constitute a prefiguration of the sort of society that we would like to live in. One that reflects values of direct democracy and egalitarianism. There's no doubt that winning gains in the present is an important step, but we should also be looking to the horizon to fundamentally change our economy and politics if we intend to provide substantial redress to the ills which plague our society. This is not us telling you to not vote in the upcoming midterms. This is, however, us telling you to hedge your bets against the ballot box and against entrenched political power generally. This is us telling you that if your goal is substantial change, then you must use the proper tools to achieve that goal, unquote. Yeah, proper tools are the way to go.
Anarchist Film Archive relaunched. From Void Network, Christie Brooks, of Stuart Christie fame, member of the Angry Brigade, and the person who wrote Granny Made Me an Anarchist, among other titles, has breathed life into the Anarchist Film Archive, where you can find an odd plethora of films in Spanish, English, Italian, etc. It would be great to have an About Us that explains their criteria, but in the meantime, you can find Adam Curtis videos, Cindy Milstein, Billy Budd with Peter Ustinov, and other fun, informative, and or aggravating films. Thanks, Christie Books, and thanks, Void Network, for announcing it.
The Return of Anok-chan, everyone's favorite meme-maliciousness. For those who need their humor broad and segregated, here's a safe space for poking fun and chewing gum, with or without gum. This also announces a site called the Society Dispatch, a, quote, web community portal for eco-extreme nihilist anarchy, posting original content as well as linking to various articles, essays, thoughts, and media from like-minded sources that are often difficult to find on the internet, unquote. Good luck to this second iteration of Anok-chan and its affiliates.
From CrimeThink, Peter Gelderloos is a solid anarchist writer who has paid his dues. There are others, like Alex Gorion, for example, who are more passionate and personable, but Peter is reliable and consistently thoughtful and thought-provoking. Here is a substantial article available through CrimeThink in EPUB, PDF, and Mobi about what we can expect from capitalism and democracy. Quote, "Crisis offers us an opportunity for a revolution that could abolish the state and capitalism, but only if we understand how domination is evolving and set out to block its advance, rather than paving the way for new forms of domination, as so many revolutionaries have done in the past. To accomplish this, we will examine the architecture of the current world system and pinpoint what exactly in this world system is failing. The diagnostic will tease out what capitalism needs to get out of the present crisis, and what proposals offer it the most promising horizon, focusing on the possibility of a bioeconomic expansion. In parallel, we will analyze the crisis of democracy, both at the level of the nation state and the level of interstate global cooperation, comparing the prospects of fascist, progressive, democratic, hybrid, and technocratic solutions to restore social peace and satisfy the needs of capitalists. Within this discussion, we will look at climate change, understanding it as a linchpin that conditions the governmental and economic crises and also suggests, or even requires, a synthesis in the responses to those two crises. Finally, we will address what all this means for us and our possibilities for action." Unquote.
Every Cook Can Abolish Governance, Part 3, Sobriety and Sabotage, from fillerpgh.wordpress.com, the website of the Filler Collective in Pittsburgh, by Lena Kafka. This piece is reminiscent of the article, I Capitalist, that is, its ruminations on how to live in the world while maintaining resistance to it, in this case through the daily grind of working in a restaurant kitchen. There are quotes of from some favorites, including Wolfie, the DuPonts, and Bonanno. Quote, "The struggle against domination and hierarchy is in and beyond the workplace. From my own experience, I've already seen that the control over the major decisions of the workplace have been outsourced to technocrats and bureaucrats, with a locus of power being those who dictate production not being on site. Maybe the focal point of our attack should be outside of our workplaces, to what causes the most damage to the flows of production. Kitchens can't operate if overstock is repurposed for our own ends. Kitchens can't operate if the trucks carrying food and other supplies don't arrive. Same goes for almost every industry. No product, no production. Attack the flows of production, there are points of weakness everywhere. All we have to do is find them and strike tactically," unquote.
Russia, anarchists, bombers, and the operation of the special services against anarchists. We are calling for solidarity. From Anonymous. Of course, the Russian state is responding, as one would predict, to the bombing of the FSB office last week. Quote, "Obviously, due to all these repressions and state terror, the younger generation of anarchists will be aware that there is no difference between armed struggle and legal protest. In any case, you will be called a terrorist and tortured. It makes young anarchists take up bombs. Unfortunately, the Russian anarchist movement is extremely fragmented and full of conflict and does not support each other during this repression. Many anarchist movements have already hurried to condemn the young bombers and disown them, saying that they have no relation to anarchism. Previously, repression against many anarchists in Russia was also ignored. Despite the rise in criminal actions and the persecution of anarchists, information about this is increasingly ignored due to personal antipathies and conjuncture considerations. We call for solidarity with all Russian anarchists subjected to repression in Penza, St. Petersburg, Moscow, Chelyabinsk, Kaliningrad, Irkutsk, and the Crimea. Russia is becoming a terrorist dictatorship, and this is already forcing young anarchists to take up bombs. Our contact information, media underscore N as in Nancy, S as in Sam, at riseup.net, unquote. I guess if you have media contacts, ask them to report on the situation in Russia. It's unclear what kind of solidarity they're asking for, but they obviously need it.
Audio and video, beer and rage, how socialism enables fascism, 15 minutes. Dude is degenerating theoretically, including switching definitions of socialism in mid-show, without explanation or clarification. This show tends to be just lists of assertions with, at most, occasional, minimal, quick and dirty references to history. This project would really benefit from someone else asking questions or encouraging the host to explain or defend his pronouncements. He's picking good topics, ones that deserve more diligence.
Beer and Rage. What the hell is a tanky? 14 minutes. The host defines what a tanky is and drinks Bud Ice. Also does word association. Explains how to find a tanky. He probably means here how to identify a tanky. And his, quote, favorite tanky term, bourgeois decadence.
Anarchy Radio, November 6, 2018. An hour. John continues his pattern of shit-talking anarchist projects that he is not involved with. In this case, the Anarchist Film Archive through Christie Books. But the Warzone distro list is okay because it lists some anti-civ titles. Go team! Otherwise, same old, same old. Shit's getting worse, and there are people taking super effective action against it. Oops, not that last part.
The Hotwire, number 43, October 31st, 2018. 47 minutes. The hosts call this the bad news episode. Environmental devastation, murder of refugees, mass racist and anti-Jewish shootings in the U.S., an interview with a Jewish anarchist who works with the Tree of Life Synagogue, someone in Brazil about the election of Bolsonaro. This podcast is usually at its best when the hosts pose questions to each other, even though that exchange always ends with an unsatisfying and obligatory rapprochement.
Welcome to Redacted, the only show where we swan dive out of the binary and straight into the gray. This is Suds, and this week we will be talking about a topic that I know is near and dear to all of my anti-capitalist friends. We'll be talking about money. So just to kind of define a little bit of this as we go forward, I think that there are a couple of notes here that are worth discussing. One of them is that anarchism, anarchy, and so much of its school of thought for so long has been marred by this idea of populism that I think probably came in a little bit from Marxism over the years. And the way that populism is defined is as it presents the quote-unquote people as a morally good force against the so-called elite, who are perceived as corrupt and self-serving. And with so much propaganda that has existed over the past several decades or the past several centuries, populism is certainly something that all of us know to exist. I think another big point here is DIY punk had a sort of effect on this idea of money-making throughout the 80s and into the 90s and even sort of as it collapsed in the early 2000s, where there was this notion that if you were to have this small side hustle, it was fine in principle, but if you were to actually be making legitimate money or actually be good at making money, that you're in some way immoral. And one of the only ways that I can even think to discuss this is sort of along the lines of a soldier who might be very talented and enjoy doing it. So today I am joined with co-hosts Hemlock and Plast, and I'm going to go ahead and jump into our first question here, which is sort of about trying to figure out what attack can look like from this sort of insecure space that it seems like all of us seem to romanticize, these sort of anti-capitalist ghettos. So Hemlock, what are your thoughts on attack from an insecure
space? I mean, it takes a lot of forms. And I think one of the things that we need to focus on when looking at like sustaining a movement, especially when we do contend with the forces of, you know, capitalism and markets and all that, is kind of like what you said, where it's like trying to find a foundation and find stability in that, but still remaining vital and confrontational as well.
And then what are your thoughts, Plast?
I want to know exactly, like, more clarification on what you mean by attack.
So there's this idea of insurrection, of essentially trying to interrupt or engage with the status quo in such a way that arrives at a place where we have more legitimate interactions with people that aren't necessarily moderated through capital or through exchange, production, time, these kinds of things. So when we think about trying to do this, when we think about trying to interrupt the status quo, or at least find ourselves in an interrupted space, is it possible to do that if we find ourselves in a vulnerable position?
I don't think so. And this brings me back to that way old thing with like the airplanes, where if it's about to go down, you have to put your mask on first before you help anyone else. You really have to have your house in order to do anything efficiently.
And so I guess, you know, in just kind of like trying to figure out how to go from there. I mean, you know, there are folks that will call themselves anti-capitalist. I've kind of moved into this position of calling myself a post-capitalist, just sort of like an acknowledgement of where we are in the today and moving forward from today as opposed to from our utopia backwards. If we can't articulate a strategy that acknowledges the fact that capitalism actually exists today, then how do you think that this affects vulnerable communities and their adoption of anarchism and sort of joining the anarchist conversation? Well, why don't we start with you, Plas?
I think there's a very real danger when it comes to anarchism. And I think that we really, really, really need to consider sort of almost not exactly like an embrace of capitalism, but a stronger acknowledgement of where we are. And it's sort of like, let's be real. Capitalist means.
Sort of let's be real in what?
That we are in a capitalist society and we need to do things through capitalism.
Gotcha. And then Hemlock, what do you have to say on the subject?
I mean, there's times when we have to engage with markets and we have to sort of like understand the reality that entails. But I really don't accept that like agorism or any kind of market politic is like where our work begins and ends. I think there's times where we find ourselves able to benefit, or not even benefit, but seek our means of survival through those means. But I don't think that that's something to strive towards. Another note on vulnerability too, as we mentioned earlier, I think it is important to note that while folks who are in vulnerable communities or circumstances or demographics or what have you, they do require like greater access to resources, and capitalism is something that restricts that. And it is also worth noting that a lot of people who are involved in or find themselves in situations like that, are really important, vital part of the movement that need to be like accommodated, and that there's a lot of willingness to act from folks who find themselves in situations like that. Some of the people I find, if I'm, you know, at a demo, the people who are down to get arrested, a lot of the time are folks who don't have to worry about having a job or a home to go to the next day. You know,
imagine my shock.
Yeah,
I definitely agree with you on that
point. And I don't know. I'm not allowed to do that because I have found myself in other situations with different anecdotal data where it's just like the harder it is for someone to find themselves in a position of comfort, whether it be someone who is a teacher who can't go to a protest because if their face is seen, then they might be removed from such an action and probably removed from their place of employment, to the multiple friends that I think many of us know who might be single mothers and simply don't have the time to actually go out and participate in anything like this, and certainly don't have the risk in their own world to actually be able to invest in something like this. Because you know, I think risk is one of those things that anarchists often overlook in an economic standard. You know,
right.
Sure, it might be free in terms of money to go and shoplift something, but the risk that you're investing in that if you get caught is actually rather expensive. And so I find that these kinds of people find themselves in a situation where it's unlikely that they'll participate unless we can actually answer to these kinds of
things. Well, again, it's the virtue of tactics too. I mean, not everyone wants or needs to be on the front lines. You know, we need people who who do anything and everything, you know? If you don't want to like go out and be in the streets, there's things you can do like behind the scenes that don't involve risk in the same way.
It's true. This wraps in kind of our last week conversation about the 5-year plans. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I think all three of us were talking about even approaching this subject is just sort of like, if what we're not doing is intending on going out and investing risk in the street, and we're still attempting to have anarchist outcomes as a 5-year plan, what does that look like? Right. And I remember years ago having conversations with Aragorn and with Brian from CrimeThink about the anarchist perspective of money in general and how income streams can really affect anarchist projects, which I think all three of us are really familiar with today in this world of Patreon and GoFundMe and all these kinds of things, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, Plast, in what ways do you think that we can incorporate our own comforts without allowing for capital to mutate our projects?
Transparency. I think if you have a project, you should have every single transaction, everything made clear to everyone who's working in the project. I think the minute you start hiding things, things tend to get really muddy. And I don't think we should necessarily shame people who have like true projects, because it really leaves you with the only option, or like the only like quote-unquote anarchist way to make money would be like you said, pay your donation out of someone's will, which I think is ridiculous.
Right. And so, Hamlock, what's your opinion of the situation?
Yeah, so I think it's twofold. So I think the first part of it is viewing projects in ways of generating capital or requiring resources as a means to an end. A lot of collectives and communes kind of find themselves in a situation where they sort of become a business that doesn't have a specific goal other than to sustain itself as it exists like in a market. And I think we always need to be looking forward and looking into how we can transform resources and capital into things that are more long-term and resource independent and don't have to exist in that place for longer than they absolutely have to. And the second would be is to not be I'm thinking of the word. Don't be like de-radicalized by involving oneself in these broader systems. I know a lot of folks who are really passionate about making change happen, and their way of doing that is working for a nonprofit. And I think that is really harmful. You know, that's a way of like de-radicalizing folks, and not that saying that, you know, those people don't have good intentions. But when you look at the amount of time that's put into those projects and the way that the resources are used, it's often more of the same, where you're just padding the pockets of suits, you know?
Well, and even beyond that, what you're really doing is pandering to your income sources, you know? Yeah. And I think this brings in the point that Plast was talking about transparency. I would almost say that anonymity is an important part of doing that kind of work, because if it is not anonymous in terms of where your donations are coming from, a person who is a project manager or whatever language anarchists prefer to use is inclined to change their behavior and change their strategies to fit their income sources rather than actually having the courage to try and do something that's different.
Right, absolutely.
And that can really kill projects.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that kind of brings up this other thing, like a sort of another Aragorn one that has always stuck with me through the years, which is this idea that rather than having our income source be anarchist, that essentially there is a firewall between that which we do for money and that which we do to experience anarchy. And just to throw out a couple of ideas that I've had in the past, and you know, maybe we can kind of talk just about some of our own experiences on this in terms of how it is that we've gotten by or how it is that we've hustled up a little cash that or resources that have helped us with our own projects. You know, in episode one, we had Arminio talk about starting up a moving company and how that was something that was going to cost. He said the low price of $20,000, and I kind of chuckled. And, you know, the the examples that I have in my life is one, I had a month that I picked up abandoned change on the ground. At the end of the month, I had $11. And at the end of that month, what I had done was essentially use the $11 to create a round of flyers for a flyer distribution company while I was in Connecticut that earned me up to $1,200 by the end of the 30 days. And I'm working on a business right now that has an only $100 startup fee. And, you know, I'll report back on that to kind of just discuss how it is that things end up. But, you know, Plas, what about you? Like, what are some different things in your mind that either generate income with a very low cost of entry or generate resources like attention or the kinds of things that you might need for projects?
I think solo projects are a great way to do... solo projects are great because they do... A lot of them are, like, essentially free. Like, you don't have to put in like a large, it's not like a land project or anything like that, and it can be accomplished by yourself and you don't need like a constant inflow of cash. And there's like lots of different free tools online and things you can use and lots of different resources you can use that are free. Group projects do take a bit more money, which is why I tend to prefer solo projects.
And then what about you, Hemlock?
I mean, if you don't want to do things that are super illegal to get your money, which is always good praxis, anything that allows you the flexibility to do work that you find is important and vital and is confrontational. A lot of folks, myself included, are used to being locked down with jobs that require you to be in a physical location for however many hours a week and essentially like own all of your time because you have to schedule everything around that. So I think having something that is flexible, ideally passive, is always good.
Yeah, and I guess one thing that I'll just point out, and then we'll start to wrap things up here, is one thing that I have also kind of picked up on, especially on the IRC, has been working solo means that you might be able to get there quick, but working with other people ends up kind of deepening the relationships that we have with ourselves and with humanity, and so... Working solo, according to this kind of outlook, is a sort of capitalist endeavor, whereas working together is a sort of anarchist endeavor. And that's right. Something that maybe we can explore during another episode. But why don't we start here? So, Plas, if you were to give advice to an anarchist reviewing money-making from an anti-capitalist perspective, what kind of advice would you give them?
Try to get a job that maximizes free time, because that has been the more than getting a job that makes you lots of money. The number one thing that has been beneficial for me is having free time, because you can get like a lot of stuff done. You can do a lot of planning. And even if you really hate yourself, I guess you could get a second job to put into a project. But time for me has been one of the most valuable things in terms of getting a project off the floor and running. Absolutely. I would say maximize time.
Well, what about you, Hemlock?
Get what you need when you need it and get out.
Hell yeah. Yeah. And I mean, so I'm going to wrap it up now and I'll just kind of echo what the two of you said there, because that's definitely true for myself. Just keep it moving. Work by yourself if you need to. Work with others if it works. And yeah, we'll wrap it up there and we will be back with everyone next week. We'll see you then.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I need fun.
That's what I want.
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 Topic of the week: no fly zones. Today's political landscape is becoming increasingly polarized. The subject of identity continues to dominate the narrative, urged on perhaps by our new augmented reality. Yet, where exactly do we map those lines in the sand? In localized communities of yore, there may have been more incentive to look beyond the tunnel vision of our personal narratives, because if we couldn't navigate civil discourse with our coworkers, families, and neighbors, there was simply no one else around. Today, we are counting coup and reporting back to our rigidly defined tribes online. Rarely does it seem like we can escape the dichotomy at gold mines. One team seeks to dominate or humiliate another and reports their victory back to their chosen camp, furthering a bias of confirmation, even if offline they find themselves celebrating utterly alone. Where do we set our ideological benchmarks? What lines are too precious to cross when we might ordinarily seek a full prism of perspectives on a particular subject? When does integrative complexity shrink back to the binary, enforcing an us versus them or our way or the highway mentality?
Well, I guess for me, and maybe I'm not the audience for this topic of the week, we have more or less been covering the same theme for a month or two now, and I'm finding it a little frustrating because how many times can we talk about us versus them in a context where pretty much everybody involved wants to frame it in terms of us versus them? And so I guess my takeaway from this topic, like others that this person has written, is what is your goal? What's your point? So I asked the author of the topic of the week, like, what are you getting at? Because of course, like, I think all of us accept the fact that we feel desperately alone. When we reach out even furtively to other people, it seems like their response is, fuck you, you're not part of our team. I get it. It's now been said sort of like as a central problem in the anarchist space for a while. So what's next? How do we break out of this? This is the much more interesting topic to me. I kind of on some level don't really know what they're getting at. So, you know, if the problems that we had in this context were just endemic of big city anarchism, then I would say, like, run to the fucking country. You know, I think that by and large, anarchism does have a problem if it's relying on big city anarchism to save it. You know, I think oftentimes people look to, like, the Bay Area and to, like, what the next cool big thing that happens in the Bay Area as a motivator for other places. But that's not going to happen. The Bay Area is done. And I would basically say the same about New York, but I just don't know what I'm talking about as much. But the point being that there just are very few projects starting in sort of like big city America. And so the question really is, like, where do we look for inspiration? And I have to admit, every time I hear about, like, the Indiana, Kansas, Missouri sort of swath of the Midwest, I get a little bit inspired because at least it still seems like people care about starting and doing new anarchist projects, even if they're very much in the model of the 90s. Thoughts?
Yeah, in the sense that, I don't know, there's kind of a idea that in city centers or larger metropolitan areas, there's the potential for a concentration of anarchists, I don't know, ideas or anarchists meeting and having different ideas versus kind of moving away from that, I guess, a dissolution of anarchists out into the general population of the country or something like that. I don't really know what that looks like in terms of projects. I know there's people in Oregon who have kind of something going on similar to that, but
it's a more of a rural environment. And I think, I mean, just to be really blunt about it, I think that because anarchism is still an age specific tendency, it still tends to be a tendency, if not about age, about people at a certain part in their life where they're not necessarily making very much money. And to put a fine point on it, If the average anarchist in North America is making $20,000 a year, then it probably can't afford to pay more than $500 a month rent. Where in North America is there any sort of history of anarchist activity where you can pay $500 a month for rent? And that tells you right there, that map tells you where interesting anarchist activity is going to happen, in my opinion. And it basically, like, you know, the bougiest towns will be college towns in the Midwest, but mostly it's going to be rural and small town Midwest America. Like, you know, in terms of inspiring anarchist activity that younger, newer people can plug into, it's not here. It's somewhere else.
So I guess just because it keeps using the word, I know that you've been, obviously you have two interviews, one published interview and one not published interview with the Tribes magazine people, which I think is an interesting take on, I guess, talking about this silo. I don't know what that experience, well, obviously that experience has been largely negative for you, I imagine, but I don't know, does that feel like there have been anything coming from that?
Well, I think the one takeaway you can get from from the interview that was just published yesterday is that they are extremely American. Like, their problems are American problems. The way in which they're going to organize each other amongst each other is going to sort of rely on some Americanisms. And the unfriendly way to say that is, like, there's a sort of uneducatedness or not cosmopolitanness to their perspective. You know, they pretend like ethnic categories are real in a way that most of us just don't experience. Well, that can only happen in an America that tells you that the fact that you're Irish Scottish matters. So to put a point on it, most of the anarchism that we're referring to as anarchism pretends like we're in Europe, or pretends like we have a, like that we're part of movements that are primarily European movements. Obviously, the most specific is Antifa. But I mean, the other strange thing about them as a category, and I think that there are other categories like this, like anarcho-capitalism, is that there are multiple very separate groups of people using the A word in this extremely, like, meaningful sense that would make that makes no sense to anyone else. And that, to me, is the value in talking to these people, is the fact that, like, they're serious when they describe themselves as anarchists, and we have no idea what they're talking about. And so I wanted to understand what they were talking about.
And just from perusing the few comments on the Attack the State website that I think was on the original, or response to the original interview with Keith Preston, like, a lot of what they were saying did mirror, in at least the terminology, it comments on things like A-News and stuff like that. So it is this weird sense of we're all using the same terms and largely having the same critiques of each other, but we're coming from such a different space that I don't really know where that, like, where that is compatible or something like that.
Well, it's it is strange. You know that Novak book that has anarchy in the title? It's basically a book that almost any college philosophy student gets. And I read it, you know, 25 years ago or something, like in my early days, but it basically frames anarchism in the logic of the state form. And so it's really strange. It's, you know, like the way in which it refers to anarchism just doesn't exactly make any sense. It doesn't seem like anything anyone would really live. That's mostly what the Attack the State people are kind of using as their terminology. So it's like they're using the same word, but it means such a, it's just conceptually just a really different idea. And nobody is willing, or seemingly nobody is willing to read each other in good faith to try to get through the, like, what does this mean? And that was, you know, really my goal with Keith Preston, was to start a conversation about, like, is there, like, we're just using the same word in such different ways, that, but we don't mean the same thing. So,
I mean, it just, it seems that even having that, what would seem like such a significant connection being, you know, the A word or something like that, the link being there so tenuous, I don't know. It seems like whenever people talk about having an intellectual silo or something like that, when you look out of your silo, it tends to be kind of a fucking wasteland. I don't really know, that usually burns you if you reach out, which.
Well, what's funny is there's another way to talk about this. And this is the way I used to talk about this all the time. I often would refer to ultra-left communists, which is a pretty rarefied specificity, as being filled with ex-anarchists. And actually right now is a really good moment to examine that, because there's this brand new magazine that's calling itself a communist magazine called Commune that just kickstarted over $60,000, very close to $70,000. Right, absolutely, and way beyond money that we can ever imagine in the anarchist space. And if you look at the masthead and the people, they have been people doing some of the most interesting anarchist projects over the past 10 years. In other words, this is a magazine absolutely fueled and energized by ex-anarchist energy, people who now call themselves communists. And so this is actually another generation of that ultra-left thing. One of the most famous prior generation ultra-left ultra-left communists who used to be anarchists is this guy, Kevin Keating. And Kevin Keating is really active in the comment section of Anarchist News, and you can actually, like, every he refers to basically people being subcultural dweebs, and but he is actually another example of an ex-anarchist who basically became an ultra-left communist. And primarily the reason why is because in their view, ultra-left communism has a greater chance for like revolutionary success or something than anarchists do. And there's perhaps, like, well, there's definitely a solid logic to this, but of course it just becomes so ridiculous when you start to get into the details, because about 10 years ago we had a conference that was a meeting of post-left anarchists and ultra-left communists. And one of the funniest things that came out in the course of that weekend-long sit-down meeting was basically the ultra-left communists having to accept the fact that they still believe in the dictatorship of the proletariat, or really the question of whether or not they do or not. Mm-hmm. And it really was a very energetic conversation and interesting, because it seems like such a naive idea that we would be building up or conceiving of sort of these clear social classes inexistent in the current condition, and that we'd be excited about what they'd do if they actually got power. Mm. Like, you know, because if Dick Pro actually happened, like, all you one can imagine is a bloodbath. Mm. An incoherent bloodbath, too.
So, the questions again. Where do we set our ideological benchmarks? What lines are too precious to cross? Well, I guess we've kind of already...
I mean, the central question for anarchists right now is, what does it mean when our best and brightest basically have about a 10-year span of time here, and then they become either communists or normies? Mm. And I think that that's a central question, but it's also unanswerable. In other words, like, do we have a vision that could be meaningful for young anarchists, or are we happy to accept that anarchism is basically this fringe movement that we find meaning in, but it's never going to be anything other than that? As someone who's newer to it, how does that make you feel? You got like 7 years left.
Yeah, I'm running down the clock, I guess. I don't know. Everything, so I've basically, it's been a year and a half now that I guess I would call myself an anarchist, and kind of scratching my way through that set of ideas and stuff, I guess has made me more insular than...
So was there a vision you thought when you didn't live in the Bay Area?
Yeah, I guess my vision was that there was kind of a groovy place that is possibly the Bay Area or somewhere else where obviously people are having conflict, but there was also people who are willing to kind of dig down and work on projects like that. And from what I've seen, that does exist somewhat, and a lot of it has moved on to an online space. But I mean, a lot of it is just kind of people talking shit. And so I imagine that isn't very conducive to projects when there's just basically a lot of people trying to tear that down without having anything on their own side.
Hmm. Hmm. What's the example that comes to mind for you?
Yeah, I mean, so because of having to work, I spend a lot of time just staring at the computer. And so a lot of that is people who have lots of very hardcore opinions on people's projects that I don't see really reflected in any other work outside of that.
So you're just referring to like in-news comments.
Yeah, I mean, and wider than that, but
mostly that. Yeah, it isn't, that is like specifically happening. Mm. It's hard to think about, you know, sort of what's the next step. Like last night, I don't know if you saw, I think it was last night, Jeff Sessions was just fired. Mm. And there were literally like leftoid human beings protesting the firing of Jeff Sessions, who is like an arch conservative, total asshole, wanted to, you know, was attempting to reinstate marijuana laws, like just total insanity. And you just look at these people, you know, holding these signs that are basically like, rehire Jeff Sessions?
I heart laws.
Yeah, I heart laws was one of them. Well, I actually saw one that did say, my political opinions are too complicated for this sign, which I thought that was in good taste. But yeah, anyways. I mean, in other words, we live in a strange time politically anyways, where like we're way beyond the point of talking about ideas or principles. We're now just talking about personalities and personalities being good or bad. Mm. And yeah. Well, thank you very much for this.
This podcast is the effort of many people. This week, the podcast was sound edited by Lynn O'Mabel. What's New was written by Jackie and read by Chisel and Dim. The editorial was written by Chisel. Aragorn and a friend talked about the topic of the week. Contact us at podcast@anarchistnews.org. To learn more, anarchist and anti-political books, pamphlets, and other material are available at littleblackheart.com. And for news by and or about anarchists and up-to-the-minute commentary, go to anarchistnews.org.